years, 6 or so years ago, when the worst stuff in my life happened to me and our church was falling apart. We didn't know if we'd even have a church. And my heart was broken, and I can't even explain what it was like during that period of my life. Had I not been the pastor, had God not told me to stay being the pastor, I wouldn't have come to church. I was too depressed. I would have just stayed home and felt sorry for myself. And probably some people wouldn't have blamed me for that. So when I see this thing of the disciples running away and missed out being the first ones to see the most amazing thing that had ever happened on the planet, and they're hiding and they're suffering needlessly, and then Thomas, who didn't even get to see the first appearance that Jesus gave to the hiding disciples, because he was bummed out and he was depressed, and the two guys on the road to Emmaus who heard the evidence and still just couldn't wrap their hearts around it, when I see that, it rings a bell with me. What happens when you're bummed out and you don't come around the body? You miss out on something. And of course, when the pastor says that, then everybody feels guilty and wants to tell me why you weren't here last week, and that's not what this is about. If you're discouraged, all of them, their whole world had just fallen apart, let alone the horror of seeing their best friend murdered. If you're discouraged, don't stay away. You might miss something really wonderful. Now, they eventually did see. Thomas did get to put his hands in Jesus's side and touched him. Did I leave something out? What did I leave out? Oh, I did. Can we rewind and go over to John? Thank you. It's right there in my notes. On the evening of that first day of the week, when the disciples were together with the doors locked for fear of the Jews, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." After he said this, he showed them his hands and his side. The disciples were overjoyed when they saw the Lord. And again, Jesus said, "Peace be with you." Why would you think he would say that twice? Well, because at the most important time, they just wimped out. I would be afraid to look him in the eyes if it was me. He says, "Oh, I'm not mad at you. Please, peace be with you. As the Father sent me, I'm sending you." And with that, he breathed on them and said, "Receive." It's aorist, imperative in Greek. "Receive now, this minute, the Holy Spirit. If you forgive anyone his sins, they're forgiven. If you don't forgive them, they're not forgiven." We'll talk about all this stuff next week. But I did want to get the Thomas thing in. Now, Thomas, called Didymus, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. And so the other disciples told him, "We've seen the Lord." "You weren't at church last week. Wow, something really wonderful happened. Too bad you missed it." But he said to them, "Unless I see," this is a yeah, right kind of thing, "unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe it, never." It's very emphatic, double negative. A week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. And though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them. It's rendered even more poignant in the Greek text. It's almost as if that detail of the doors and windows being locked was the setup for Jesus being in the room with them. "Peace be with you," he said again. Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here. Look at my hands. Reach out your hand, put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe." How did he know what Thomas had said when the other guys told him? How did he know that?
Na, 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 na.
Thomas said to him, "My Lord, my God." And then Jesus told him, "Because you've seen me, you've believed. Happy, blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." Boy, I'm so glad I read that. Okay, now back to Matthew. Yeah, and of course, I already read it. I got out of order. But let's look at these accounts. Let's try to squeeze the most out of them that we can. So what I was saying earlier, my personal testimony was, whenever I've stayed away because I was discouraged, I've always regretted it. Whenever I have pushed through, I've always been glad I came. In my case, 6 years or so ago, it was every Tuesday, every Wednesday, every Sunday on my way to church, I'm saying, "Lord, I can't do this. I cannot do this. I have nothing to give." And he said, "Well, then I'll carry you. But push through the resistance. I want you to be here." I'm so glad I did. So I passed the thing on to you. My grandma said it this way, and she died at 98. And at 98, she was still going to 3 Bible studies a week. She was still teaching guitar lessons a couple of times a week until she was 95. And then she couldn't bar chords anymore because of the arthritis, so she had to quit, and then she was just teaching saxophone, clarinet, trumpet, and accordion. She's a Yankee lady, too, so they've got spunk, those Yankee ladies. Where was I? Oh, she said, "When I feel like not going and being with the body of Christ," she said, "I always push through that because every single time I've pushed through it, I have been glad that I came." And I pass that on to you not to make you feel guilty, because like I said, if I hadn't been the pastor, I would have stayed home. I wouldn't have come, and I would have missed out. So let the little warning light go off when you're that thought, "Oh, I won't be any good to anybody. I'll just probably cry or, you know, I'm just too bummed out. I think I'll stay home." Man, just don't fall for that. Push through it. You'll be glad that you were with the body. Now, could Jesus meet you at home? Yes, he could. In fact, that's our prayer when you're not here. Well, Lord, wherever they are, be with them. Let them know that you're there. Comfort them. But there's something about the body being together. I find it so cool that these women, even though the men ran away, and even though they couldn't do anything to change the circumstances, they still wanted to be there. And I just love that. When they went to see the tomb, they still weren't on the clue bus either. They didn't think they were going to find an empty tomb. They just went, they didn't know he'd risen from the dead yet. But they got to be the first ones to see him. Which, I suppose you could write a book about it and, you know, get a little bit extra royalties for being that first eyewitness. Maybe Oprah would have you on or something on her show. But why be the first ones? It was just a cool thing to me that the angel was there, did his little speech. "Go in, look at the folded, you'll appreciate the folded bed, you know, grave clothes. Nice touch. Notice the hospital corners. Bounce a quarter off of it." But then he sends them on their way to go tell the disciples, and Jesus just can't wait. And I love that. On our other screen, the meanwhile in chapter 28 is verse 2 about the angel. There being an earthquake. Now, was the earthquake because the stone was moved? We know it wasn't the earthquake that moved the stone. It was the angel that moved the stone. So don't know what the deal is with that. But when you see the size of the hole those of you that are going to Israel, when you see the size of the hole and the size of the trough that they rolled this, it's not perfectly round. It was flat in various places so that you could push it a little, push it a little, push it a little. And it was also on a little bit of an incline or a decline so that it was easier to roll the cover. It would have taken more people to roll it away from the opening than it would have to roll it in front of it. When you see the size of all that, you realize this was a hefty stone. How many soldiers did it take to put it in place? Don't know. Probably a bunch of them. One angel. I do love this little detail. Matthew does redeem himself with a few cool details. I love the detail of the angel rolls the stone away and then sits on it. Personally, it doesn't tell us why he did that. It wasn't so it wouldn't move. We know that. I think it's kind of a guy thing. Ooh, 50 big, tough soldiers. Ooh, watch this. You know, flicks that thing up there, hops on it. So much for your security measures. Human. That's the way I see it, and I'm a guy, so if anyone has any perspective on that, I would... Is it just me, or does the angel look like he just kind of wants to get out of there? You know, he's sitting around, you know, waiting for somebody to come, and, you know, here's the spiel, you know, when somebody comes, tell him he's not here, and, of course, the women were the first to show up, and he says, go quickly. I underlined that word the first, because I trip over stuff. I tripped over that word, that little adverb, and I thought, why go quickly? They're going to find out eventually. As the story unfolds, we're going to see that Peter and John race each other to the tomb after the women come and tell. So they're going to find out. Why quickly? Why go quickly? Any ideas? Na, 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 na. He didn't want them suffering hopelessness any longer than necessary. Now, folks, they shouldn't have been hopeless. They should have believed him to begin with. Why tell the women to run? Go tell them now, right this minute. Let's not have them thinking it's all over 1 minute longer than necessary. And then Jesus couldn't even wait for that to happen before he interrupted them. What does it tell you about him? Next time the thought crosses your mind that you should just lay low and not bug God because he's pretty ticked off at you because you're a failure, read these words again and remember Jesus wanted to be with these people and they all failed him. He wanted to reassure them. He wanted to restore them. They would have missed it all, but for his initiative. Hold that thought. Oh, Bob, but you don't know how I've failed. Hey, my failures are going to beat up your failures any day. But I cling to these things. I cling to these details because it tells me about him. Here he's just done the most cosmically significant thing ever done on the planet. That's just the raising from the dead part, let alone the taking the sins of the world on himself and the temple and the veil being torn like we looked at last week. Pick up that CD, by the way. It will bless you. Not only had he done all that, but what's he thinking about? Is he calling for a press conference? And okay, I just conquered death, hell, and the grave. All right, I want a limo from now on. I would like, you know, security detail, and I want to receive the attention that I deserve. Is he even thinking about himself? He's thinking, I do not want these people depressed one more minute. Which they wouldn't have been had they believed him those 8 times that he told them. I just love that heart. Aren't you glad God repeats himself? Do you need to hear stuff more than once? I do. I have to listen to the very CDs afterwards because if I don't, I write out a letter of resignation and think I'm a failure. I shouldn't be a pastor, blah, blah, blah. And I'll listen. Have to listen to the CD just to absorb the words that come out of my mouth when I say, Lord, I want words more than my own, because these people need words more than my own. I have to hear it more than once. Thank you, Cliff and Sue, for bringing Joe Foch's CDs to me. They have saved my life midweek more than once. But I love that adverb. Go quickly. Tell the disciples. I love the folded grave clothes. What's the point? Is he just as resurrected if he doesn't fold the clothes? I don't know. What about the Shroud of Turin? I was thinking about this. Do you think that's a real deal? It's the right material. It, according to all of the carbon dating and everything, it seems to be the right age. It does bear a photographic negative of what appear to be human features, which what would happen if intense light had passed through it suddenly. It's kind of intriguing. I don't know. Inquiring minds want to know. Whoever found it, was it folded when you found it? In fact, John says it was folded in two separate places. The little part that goes over the head was folded in one place, and then the long windy part was all folded in another place. Why? I don't know, but I just really like that. Does that mean that if you're sloppy, God doesn't love you? No. It just means that he loves us tidy people even more. Did I say that out loud? I think I probably did, didn't I? So the women hurried away from the tomb, afraid, yet filled with joy. And Jesus just said, you know what? This is just not good enough. I love these women. They are my sisters. They stood by my side, risking their lives when the big, tough disciples ran away. I just can't wait a minute longer. But I just love the casualness of the howdy. I don't know why I really like that. I love the interchange. We're not going to look at it today. But I love the interchange specifically with Mary Magdalene. Just her and Jesus in the garden. I've got a lot of mileage out of that. Like I said, we wouldn't have time. We'd have to take 2 or 3 weeks if we were going to cover every single appearance. We're looking at one aspect of, we're looking at the tenderness and thoughtfulness of Jesus toward people who failed. And I suspect that somebody needs to hear this. I know I do. So Jesus appears, says howdy, and they dove for his feet. I've had one dream in my life, and I don't have spiritual dreams very often, but the ones I do have, I remember them. I had one spiritual dream about meeting Jesus and hugging him, only it was a man hug. I wasn't diving for his feet, but I distinctly remember all of the sensations in that dream. And one of them is I threw my arms around him, and his beard smelled like wood shavings and wood smoke, the way that a carpenter's beard would smell. And I remember, some of my dreams have smell-o-vision, and some don't. I remember muscles in his shoulders. And I remember I was in a long line of about hundreds of thousands of people. Some of them I recognize, and we were all walking slowly, not like zombies, but just kind of slowly and expectantly towards the high green mountains with this big, beautiful city in it. And Billy Graham's down there, and he's walking, and my grandpa and my brother and Chuck Smith, and we're all sort of walking along there, and we see this figure running towards us. And after a while, I realize it's Jesus. And I know I can outrun Billy Graham, but I probably can't outrun my brother. So I start running, and I'm looking, and he's running, and his hair's blowing out behind him, and he's got, you know, his robes hitched up so that he can run, and he's running, and he makes a beeline for me. And in my dreams, I can dunk a basketball and outrun, you know, T.O. and all of that stuff in my dreams. So I was the first one there. And I grabbed him and I wrapped my arms around him, and I just, and he was laughing. That's the thing I remember. He's just laughing, like, you're just so happy. And after a while, I thought, oh man, the line that is going to be behind me waiting to do this. So I sort of relaxed, like you do when the hug is over. Men, all men understand this. You know, the hug's over. Okay, we're done. Enough intimacy. And I let go, but he wouldn't let go. And he just kept laughing and kept laughing. Finally, I reached up and I sort of pushed them away a little bit. And he said, what are you doing? And I said, well, you know, we've got to give these other guys a chance. And he laughed again. He says, you don't understand. I'm doing this with every one of them right now, too. That dream changed my theology about heaven. Because up until then, I had seen heaven as an eternal church service. Wasn't sure I wanted to go. Me and a bazillion people out there listening to all the disciples give speeches, hearing all the special music, and then just waiting for my chance to go up and sit on Santa Claus's lap. But then I realized I had Jesus all to myself yesterday. You probably thought you did. Well, you probably did. So is heaven going to be me and him? One-on-one forever? Yeah. Is heaven going to be you and him? One-on-one forever? Yeah. Changes everything, doesn't it? Free little sermon, no charge for that one. They dove for his feet and worshiped, and he says, don't be afraid. Now, this is an interesting sequence. They know he's real. They're hugging his feet. They know it's not a hallucination. But listen to the sentence as Matthew records it. Don't be afraid, go and tell my brothers. So it makes it, I think, a legitimate translation that he's saying, don't be afraid to go tell those guys. Why would they have been afraid? Do you know that in that culture in those days, women were not allowed to give testimony in court? They were considered unreliable witnesses. I love how God busts out of stuff like that. He says, you guys, you're the ones that are here. You go. Don't be afraid. Maybe they'll laugh at you. Don't worry. Just go tell them. And I love that Jesus calls them brothers. And I love that he says, okay, go where you feel safe. Go back home. Go to Galilee. I know it's not safe here. And I'll meet you there. I know where you live. You know, I'm picturing in my mind when he said, of course, he does meet them later in Galilee, but what I'm picturing in my mind as we're driving on our air-conditioned tour bus around that north end of Galilee, we all loved Galilee. I think it was probably our favorite part. It's just gorgeous countryside, and we're there at the north end of the Sea of Galilee, and I'm driving along, and you go past Bethesda or Bethsaida, and then you go to Capernaum, and you're looking out here, and he goes, this is where he sent him. He says, go there. I know where you live. I know, Peter, I know your mother-in-law's house, and I've delivered chairs, you know, to all those places when I was working in Capernaum. Just go where you feel safe.